You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I know many of you, but for those of you I don't know, my name's Michael Heflin, and I work at OSF based in the Washington, D.C. office, and I'm with the Human Rights Initiative, which is a global grant-making program, and I direct the equality work within the Human Rights Initiative, which includes our global support for LGBTI rights activism. And I came to Open Society about 5 years ago to launch a global initiative on LGBTI rights. So it's great to be here and be able to talk a little bit about the work we're doing and how that work relates to what Mark has been doing through his fellowship the last year and a half or so. And I guess, you know, what I want to do first, of course, is introduce Mark Gavescher, who has been working as an OSF fellow for, is it
18 months?
18 months. And I think for me, anyhow, from a program perspective, his fellowship is ideally designed fellowship. Because it's very much in line with our program and with what we've been trying to examine as a program as we've been developing OSF support for LGBTI rights work internationally. But Mark has been looking very specifically at the LGBTI rights movement as in the context of globalization and as an evolving global social movement, and how that's working in different parts of the world, how that kind of evolution as a movement, a social movement, with forces in various places, with people working on the issues in various places, how that's playing out in different contexts. And he's been traveling all around the world, and we've had a chance to have a dialogue for a good part of his fellowship, but I'm very anxious to hear where he's at now. And so we thought we'd start this out by him doing a little presentation on sort of some of the key ideas that he's thinking about coming out of the travel and the work that he's been doing the last year and a half, and then go from there into a conversation. I have some questions to ask him. I know he has some questions to ask me. And of course, we want to open it up to all of you so that we can make it a real discussion.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's great to be doing this with Michael. We're told that one of the great advantages of being an Open Society Fellow is that you get to plug into this extraordinary network of social movement people, idea entrepreneurs all over the world. And that network is, we're told, one of the greatest things about becoming an Open Society Fellow. And notwithstanding that you were all restructuring for most of the time of my fellowship, which meant it was sometimes very difficult to get hold of you, notwithstanding that, it really has been my experience in the work I've done with these thematic programs and in the country offices or the regional offices I've worked. And it's just been an extraordinary, it's been one of the greatest blessings of this fellowship to have connected with Michael and his team of Eastern Europeans and Africans in the LGBTI rights initiative. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's kind of grounded me and grown me in ways I really hadn't expected. So it's just a thrill to be doing this with Michael here today and to be checking in with each other. I'm also conscious of the fact that you are a group of people who are here because you want to help make the world different or better. And so I know I'm talking to funders and grant makers. So in my thinking aloud, I'm thinking aloud about the work you do and how you might do it differently, particularly in this field. I'm open to sort of questions about that too. I mean, that's one of my obligations as a fellow, is to engage with you all about the work you do and to talk it through with you. So my project, for want of a better word, is called the Global Sexuality Frontier. It should be called the Global Sexuality and Gender Identity Frontier, and I will come up with a title that holds both concepts properly. And the question I asked in this project, which is coming to a close now, is there's a global conversation happening around sexual orientation and gender identity, which was unimaginable 10 years ago. Unimaginable. And I want to try and it's a global conversation. It's happening in a village in rural Tamil Nadu where I'm working. It's happening in Arkhangelsk, the Russian city I'm working in. It's happening in Ann Arbor, where I've just been, in ways that are really unexpected. And what I'm trying to understand is what's provoking this conversation, and how is this conversation different to previous global movement conversations, say, for example, around women's rights or civil rights, because of the era of globalization in which we live. And not only what is provoking this conversation, but what effect is this conversation having in the different places where I'm working? How is this conversation changing the way people are thinking, reacting, understanding themselves, understanding their society in the places I'm working, rural Tamil Nadu, Ann Arbor, Cape Town, Ibadan, etc.? And what I thought I would do is I'd begin this discussion with some sort of eavesdroppings I've had on this global conversation, which I think raise the issues I'm interested in exploring in my work. So the first little snippet of dialogue I want to share with you is a snippet that came out of an infamous meeting that the Open Society Foundations actually funded. And that was this, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, this is this meeting that happened in St. Petersburg before the Sochi Olympics that the Russian authorities bugged. It was a meeting of international activists and Russian LGBT activists around how the activists could use the Sochi moment to gain some traction in Russia and globally. I was at that meeting. Michael's colleague Max organized that meeting. And we all found out that it was bugged when some audio from that meeting was used in an absolutely scurrilous Russian TV show called Play Actors, which was a kind of a hell and damnation to gay people show on Russia's major federal TV channel at prime time. And one of the things that happened so there was a studio audience, and one of the people in the studio audience is Vitaly Milonov, who is the leader of the anti-gay movement. He's a St. Petersburg deputy. He's the leader of the anti-LGBT movement in Russia, and he was one of the studio audiences. And the host, Arkady Momontov, played a little extract in which one of the LGBT activists at this Open Society Foundation-supported meeting said, well, you know, some of the LGBT activists who are also members of the sports, the national teams, are thinking of walking hand in hand, same-sex hand in hand at the opening ceremony. And at this, Vitaly Milonov exploded. You know, we heard this, the audio of this, and this is a man named Konstantin who runs the Russian LGBT sports network. We heard him say this, and then we went straight to Vitaly Milonov, who exploded on camera and said, if this happens, I'm not going to let my children watch the Olympics on television. And there was one sensible person on the panel in the studio, a celebrated feminist writer named Maria Arbatova. And she shouted back at him, throw your TV away. Let your children remain completely ignorant about the world. And I thought that in that moment was encapsulated the terms of the sort of global culture wars that are currently being fought on the terrain of LGBT rights. You know, on one hand, you've got Arbatova, the cosmopolitan intellectual, who's embraced the inevitable process of globalization, who understands that people watch television, you know, and that because of the digital age, there are no boundaries. But on the other hand, and it's very important to understand where he comes from, you have Milonov, who's the fearful provincial, who's trying to protect his children from the consequences of this process of globalization. And I felt we had that acted out in that little moment. So that's my one little snippet that I want to throw out there. Mm-hmm. My next little snippet happened immediately after Yoweri Museveni signed the Ugandan anti-homosexuality bill into law in January. And I'm assuming you all know about that legislation. I don't need to tell you about it. So he said something really interesting, Museveni, when he signed it. And I'm not sure if we heard him well enough. He said, there's now an attempt at social imperialism to impose social values. We're sorry to see that you, and by you he meant the West because he was speaking to Western journalists, we're sorry to see that you live the way you live, but we keep quiet about it. And why I think that's significant is because it's a... Okay, no, before I tell you why I think that's significant. So the BBC went to the US ambassador, Scott Leesy, to get his comment from this. And Scott Leesy responded, and here's what Scott Leesy said. Keeping mothers alive, helping people with AIDS, dealing with food security, that's all about our values as Americans. And if that's cultural imperialism or social imperialism, then I'm a social imperialist. And I think that there are two things in that dialogue that I want to bring out. The first is what Museveni is saying, which is very different from what Robert Mugabe said when he first introduced this idea of homosexuality as something un-African in response to the LGBT movement, or the gay movement as it was then in Zimbabwe over a decade ago. He said homosexuality is un-African. And in fact, that's what the Nigerians are saying too. That's what Senator David Mark in Nigeria says. But Museveni is not saying homosexuality is un-African. He's saying talking about it is un-African. Saying we do things differently here. We have it. We've always had it. And Museveni actually has often said, I know there's homosexuality in our cultures. But what's different is this notion of publicity. What's different is this notion of turning it into an identity rather than something you do on the side. And we make room for it if you want to do it on the side. But what's different is this idea that that you turn it into an identity and you campaign for rights around it. Making a noise about it is what's different. And you know what? He's right. He's absolutely right, Museveni. You can't fault him on that argument. But then let's listen to how Scott Leesy responds, claiming that he's a social imperialist because he's putting out values that are American values, which we would all agree are good values, right? You know, food security, helping people with AIDS, etc. But there's, in the tone, he speaks with a tin ear, Scott Leesy, because there's something in his tone which is so paternalistic and which is only going to inflame a counter-reaction because precisely of the way it leaves African leaders feeling disempowered. And I think this is really important to understand when one understands the kind of homophobia that's sparking on the African continent at the moment, which is that in many ways, as with Milonov, it's a fearful reaction to globalization, but it's also the reaction of leaders of failed states who have nothing to offer their people because of globalization and because of their own kleptocratic history, except for values. You know, there's one index on which an African leader can lead, and that's the index of values. And the more disempowered the African elites feel by Americans who come in to help people, you know, who have AIDS, to keep mothers alive, with food security, the more these leaders are going to counter-react by saying, you know, we're guys too, we have values, you know, they're going to need to puff up their chests. And therefore, a closed circle kind of becomes a snowball that rolls down the hill. And that's extremely disempowering for queer people themselves on the continent because of the way this dialogue perpetuates itself. So that's my second snippet. My third snippet it's not a dialogue. But two things that were said by the Senegalese president, Macky Sall. One was said by the Senegalese president, Macky Sall, and the other was said by a really brilliant Ukrainian LGBT activist, one of the leaders of the Ukrainian movement, a lawyer named Olga Shevchenko. Mm-hmm. And they're talking in different places, I think, about the same thing, but from different perspectives. So Macky Sall, who is one of Africa's, well, I don't know, it's changing. He came into power as one of Africa's more progressive leaders in one of Africa's more democratic states, Senegal, but was very clear, as you'll remember, when he was, you know, up against Barack Obama and asked about decriminalization of homosexuality, that he was not going there. And he was asked recently by Die Zeit, the German newspaper, about his position on homosexuality. And this is what he said. He said, "In Africa, we have our way of life. Some you may see as bad, some good. We have polygamy, for example, in some areas. A man may have several wives. This is a lifestyle. This is a social phenomenon. Can Africans demand Europeans that they also allow polygamy? This is our culture, not yours. That's boilerplate. We've heard that a million times, right? That's not new. What he says next is interesting. Maybe that will change. It takes time." So Die Zeit asks for clarification and says, "You mean it's a matter of time before the same-sex partnerships in Africa will be allowed?" And Macky Sall responds, "That's possible. You have the same-sex partnerships in Europe also only since yesterday, and you ask it today from Africans. This is all happening too fast. We live in a world that is slowly changing." So forgive that. This was in French, translated into German, and then translated into English, which is why it sounds like my Yiddish grandmother. But, but you hear what he's saying. Okay, now listen to Olga Sevchenko. This is what Olga said to me when I met her at an ILGA conference in 2012. And also remember that Olga's working in an environment where the global culture wars really are being instrumentalized around LGBT stuff, where there's signs that say Euro equals homo, and where there was a billboard campaign sponsored by a Russian proxy that showed two stick figures of boys together holding hands and two stick figures of girls together holding hands with a slogan that said, "If you join the European Union, you will have same-sex marriage," right? That's the Ukraine. But this is what Olga said to me. Olga said, okay, so remember what Macky Sall said to Die Zeit. Things change, but we need to go slowly, right? Slowly, slowly. Give us time. What you want us to do today has taken you a century. Listen to what Olga said. Olga said, "The problem we face is that Ukrainian society is not ready for LGBT rights." Now, this is the lead Ukrainian activist saying this. "But Ukrainian LGBTs," this is now back in Olga's words, "but Ukrainian LGBTs themselves, they cannot be restrained anymore. They go online. They watch TV. They travel. They see how things can be. Why should they not have similar freedoms? Why should they be forced to live in hiding? The world is moving so fast and events are overtaking us in Ukraine. We have no choice as activists but to try to catch up." So Macky Sall and Olga Sevchenko are describing the same phenomenon but from different perspectives. Macky Sall is saying, "Hey, you Westerners, hey, you Open Society Foundation, hey, you Barack Obama, you're making us go too fast." And Olga's saying, "Well, you know, actually, the people who are making us go fast are the people themselves." And that's really what my work is about. My work is about looking at groups of young people in six different countries now, even though I've traveled in a lot more, thanks to you guys, at young people in six different countries and how they are trying to negotiate their way in this global dialogue, and how they're shuttling between a kind of global sense of citizenship they have, sexual citizenship, gender identity citizenship, that they're getting online, or they're getting from international movements, or they're getting from the AIDS movement in many ways, in South Asia and in Africa, and how they're trying to reconcile that with this kind of offline analog reality on the ground, you know, where things have not changed, and they're fascinating as a generation in that way, and I'm seeing that. All over the way they're driving the change. And so the way I want to conclude is because I mentioned to you that I'm just back from Ann Arbor, where I've been studying the natives as well. and what I'm looking at in the United States is the trans explosion. And the way suddenly there's a generation of young people who are stepping across the binary or stepping off the gender binary as never before. And what I'm hearing and what I'm understanding, after having spoken to young people themselves, but also to professionals who work in this field, and mainly mental health and medical professionals, because I'm looking at the phenomenon of early transition too. And you all might have some ideas for this as well. I know that there's some people in this room who identify as trans. Is that this has led, in a way it's kind of weirdly, it seems to me, and I'm thinking this aloud, it weirdly feels like the AIDS movement in some ways, and that it's being led by people themselves because of the information they're getting online. So, in other words, this hormone blocking medication, Lupron, which prepubescent kids can go onto to delay puberty before they start taking cross hormone medication, has been available in Iran for ages, and was used to treat other conditions, and then was sort of studied and pioneered in the Netherlands. And doctors became interested in it here because they had more and more patients who were presenting and were saying, you know, my child is trans and has the right to be trans, and I'm not going to stand for reparative therapy the way previous generations did. And so the movement seems to be coming from parents and young people themselves. And certainly in the kind of the throwing away the gender binary that's happening. And it's fascinating to me, and I don't mean in any way to belittle the queer movement or the anti-binarist movement by saying they is the new gay. What I mean by that is that one of the young people I went to meet, I've been interviewing in Ann Arbor, their name is Sean. They're 17. They're a faculty brat. Their kids are, you know, a philosopher and a medic at U of M. They came home and they said, "Mom, Dad, I'm gay." And their parents said, "Wonderful, honey, this is what we fought for. We're so happy. Like, we'll have even higher status in our Unitarian Church congregation. This is just perfect. It's perfect." Like, where's Sean's room for self-expression? And the way that self-expression and movement, you know, whether it's like the 60s, whether it was the 60s, you know, generational rebellion or the generational rebellion of my era, how do you do that in that sort of environment? And so people like Sean have pushed the boundaries and come back and said, "My partner is a trans woman and we are both to be identified as they." And their parents are freaking out. And I'm not saying this is empty rebellion. I'm saying this is fascinating progress. It's the way movements begin. And sure, there are... So I learned this expression in Ann Arbor that I'd never heard before, which is transtrender. Which transtrender means you're kind of trans because it's trendy as a kid. And it's similar to... In my day, it was LBG, lesbian before graduation. Or SMUG, Smith undergraduate lesbian. I forget how it went, but this idea that you kind of, for political or social reasons, you join a movement and then you step off once you need to kind of become an adult and get a job and blah blah blah. And I mean, it's great that even there's that expression transgender is really interesting to me because it creates the space for people who actually are trans, or who do need to step off the binary, or who wouldn't have been able in another era to step off the binary. This is all fresh in my head, and you're the first people I'm talking to about it, so forgive me for rambling. I should probably stop there, and we should talk.
Thanks, Mark, and I think you made a lot of really interesting points. I mean, one, I just want to reflect on a couple, and then maybe to open it up for conversation. But, you know, I think one of the things that you've identified is, you know, and again, I think it's both a strength and also one of the challenges with globalization and access to the internet is it's very hard to contain the conversation. So, you know, our support for LGBTI rights work globally for the most part, focuses on supporting LGBTI organizations that are emerging to advocate for the rights of their constituencies in their different countries and cultural contexts. And one of the one of the things that they tell us is that they often will have conversations among themselves about how they stage the conversation in their particular country context or cultural context. So, I'm thinking back about activists that we work with in Kenya and saying, we're very clear that we don't want to talk about same-sex marriage, for example. We know that that's the issue that will draw out the opposition in the strongest way. And so what we want to focus on is violence and talk about state and non-state actor violence. I mean, that's something people in general experience, and so we can relate to the broader human rights movement. It's something that connects us to the broader society and concerns that people generally have. We want to talk about access to essential services, the things like that. But, the next day there could be an internet article about a Kenyan immigrant in the UK who gets married to, someone in the same-sex couple in the UK gets married, one of them's Kenyan immigrant, and it's all over the press in Kenya. So how do they stage the conversation, in that kind of global context? And again, I think it is a real dilemma because on the one hand, I think activists in the Global South and Sub-Saharan Africa benefit, and they would argue that they benefit from being connected to this global network, that they're able to leverage, access resources. When something terrible happens, they're able to mobilize international campaigning, sometimes helpful, sometimes not helpful, but they're able to access that. And the fact that we're all connected in the way that we are enables that to happen, but it also makes it very hard for them to do anything to kind of stage the conversation. And I think it's it could be a good thing on many levels. I think about the struggles in the Western context, the European context, and U.S. context, the way the set of letters continue to evolve. And maybe in other places, the fact that there needs to immediately begin to have a conversation around gender identity and not just sexual orientation is benefit in the sense that they're not, yes, but it also makes it more complicated and creates a situation where beginning to engage with the broader society, especially when the broader society really, isn't even at kind of point A in understanding the issues, it becomes very, very complicated very quickly. And I think that, and that's a challenge for the organizations that we work with.
Yeah, listen, two riffs off that rather than direct answers to that. Firstly, let's just not take either Macky Sall or Yoweri Museveni at their words, right? So Museveni says we keep quiet about it, and that's the difference between us and you, but really, the one case that's been prosecuted now are people whose privacy was invaded in their own homes.
Absolutely.
So that's bullshit. He's playing that game, but nonetheless clamping down on people's privacy anyway. And in terms of Macky Sall saying, you want us to do today what you've taken a century to do. No one in Senegal's asking for gay marriage, for LGBT marriage. The act in they're setting up this boogeyman. Right, the act in Nigeria is called the Same-Sex Prohibition Marriage Act. You won't find anybody, even in Nigeria, it's a little bit different in Kenya and in Malawi, which I'll talk about in a minute. But no one in Nigeria has even provoked things by holding a public same-sex marriage. That happened in Malawi and caused huge social crisis there, and in a smaller scale, it happened in Kenya, but that hasn't happened in Nigeria. And yet this act is called the Anti-Same-Sex Marriage Act. So it's very easy for these cultural essentialists who are looking for scapegoats or ways to show that, ways to get support and to show that they have power, or in a Nigerian context that, they're as tough as the Muslims are or whatever, to kind of use same-sex marriage as a boogeyman when it's not on the agenda at all. What's on the agenda is, as Michael said, security. So that's my one observation. My second observation is that it's what's just happened in India shows the power of, let's say, SOGI rather than sexual orientation and gender identity. Rather than the kind of LGBT alphabet and rather than leading with sexuality, because in India the Supreme Court throughout legislation, throughout a ruling that decriminalized homosexuality, but has just given an extraordinarily progressive ruling on the rights of transgender people. And there's really interesting and troubling research from West Africa. And I'm seeing a little bit of it in South Asia too, but South Asia is different and I don't know it as well, around how gender non-conforming identities, which have always been part of West African societies, and I'm thinking specifically about the Godigen in Senegal, but there are equivalents in Togo that I heard some research about, in Ghana, how those identities have totally gone underground since the gay rights thing has come up in society. Because the space that was made for gender non-conforming people, or people who we might call trans, has kind of become scary now that they've been identified with the sexuality rights movement. Mm-hmm. And I saw that in a really interesting way, beginning in a really interesting way in the Philippines too. And I spoke about this. How many here were at my last talk? Only two. So forgive me for those if I repeat myself, but I spoke about Bakla in the Philippines and how this really interesting thing is happening in the Philippines that I found fascinating. It's happening a little bit in India as well, where you've got this category called Bakla. And Bakla basically means like a sexual bottom as opposed to a top. But it's come to mean any non-conforming on sexuality or gender man. So I am Bakla, even though I can present, what you might disagree, but I think I can present as male pretty effectively. I'm Bakla, but a person who has had top surgery and presents as a woman is also Bakla. We're all Bakla. It's the gender continuum. It's precisely the gender continuum or the gender web or the gender spectrum that Americans are fighting for here. Like, how great, you think? Problem is that if you are on the more female side of the Bakla spectrum, there's very little you can do. You can be a beauty queen or a hairdresser. And, you know, you'll be loved as a hairdresser. And, you know, you'll have a good life as a hairdresser, but you're not going to become a doctor or a university professor or run for Congress. So there's now a transgender movement, a Western transgender movement. They are T's in the LGBTI, who are part of the global transgender movement. Mainly trans women, but some trans men too. And one of them actually led an LGBT party in the last election campaign. Her name is Bems Benedito. And her point is, I'm going to show you I can go to Congress, even though I'm trans. But in doing that, I need to tell all you Bakla that you have false consciousness. You really need to embrace that you are women. And stop thinking of yourselves in this kind of third gender swamp, right? Own your womanhood and go for it, girl. And there's this really interesting tension between the trans movement and Bakla people. And I'm not going to weigh down on one side or the other, but this is a very roundabout way of saying to you, Michael, that we need to take on how gender identity plays in other parts of the world and incorporate it into the way we think about these struggles.
So I want to open it up. I mean, I have many other questions I could ask, but we could open it up for... Why don't you start?
I'm Keto. I've been working here on and off for the last 13 years, and I'm currently consulting as the curator of the permanent collection of photography in the building. And I'm trans-identified and, like, holding it down for the in-between. I use they pronouns outside of here for the most part. And I'm sort of part of, I guess, this wave of gender nonconformity. And there's a lot. Like, I have a whole list of things that we can talk about here or elsewhere. But I guess starting with that, Something that I've been trying to work out in my head is, as we break down the gender binary, all of the ways that it plays out, like language movements, you know, it's not just about, there's passport rights and sort of state recognition of alternate gender identities or third gender identity or, you know, that in between. When you start thinking about it as a spectrum and you stop thinking about male and female and really, like, open up to that, the Buckler thing is really, it's interesting. But so things like legal recognition and then language rights, but then I'm also interested in, like, that cultural shift also, which I'm curious how you've seen it playing out in different places. I think that your story about the Ukraine was really interesting because I think that the development of online identity, which is where trans people find the most community, especially outside of limited urban hubs like what we have here in Brooklyn, is very different from the Ukraine. And that gap between how people are able to understand themselves and find community online versus what it's actually like out in the world, you know, and the language shift and the cultural shift to me are you know, the legal rights is really important because it's that state recognition piece, but, like, how do we as a movement or how do we as funders of a movement or, you know, just how do we start addressing that, the other shifts that need to happen in order to make it acceptable?
So I'm so glad you asked that question because, in fact, in my long riff through the Buckler, I didn't get to my second response to Michael's observation about the difficulties of doing this work in environments where you cannot contain the debate. I think as funders and grant makers, there needs to be so much more attention to media and to social media and to empowering your grantees or the beneficiaries of your grantees to your grants to engage in this. And in working and understanding the media sphere, and in working with and understanding the media sphere, and in working with media practitioners as well, which is more challenging now than it was when I did media trainings for gay organizations in South Africa 20 years ago, because, you know, everyone is a journalist now, everyone blogs now.
Yeah.
But still, it's really interesting to see the way in Malawi, for example, which is... Okay, very, very quick little case study of Malawi. Country of 4 million people. Nothing happens there at all, except for tobacco growing. And a young trans woman who is one of my primary subjects, who is now a refugee in Cape Town, watching satellite TV from South Africa, which is all over the continent, sees that men can marry in South Africa, black men can marry, doesn't actually think of herself as a man, but thinks, hey, you know, they did it there, let's do it here. So holds a public engagement ceremony. The shit hits the fan. She and her partner get sentenced to 14 years in jail. She is eventually pardoned. For a lot of reasons, you know, Madonna gets on the bandwagon, Ban Ki-moon gets on the bandwagon. But the main reason is that the Americans say, you've got a, through some congressional fund they have, you've got a huge infrastructure grant from us. There's some governance issues we're holding back on giving this to you. So the president is forced into pardoning these two people. The guy gets arrested shortly afterwards for stealing a cell phone and is back in jail. But Tiwonga herself, who's the person who started this, gets asylum in South Africa and has a very tough life there in Cape Town. Very, very tough life. At the same time, a movement is sparked. There's social crisis in Malawi and a movement is sparked. And a really smart group of human rights activists bubble to the fore, supported by you guys, and begin changing things. And one of them now has a column in the newspaper that caused all the shit to begin with. And progressive imams hold press conferences about tolerance. And I mean, it's an important narrative because a couple of lives got wrecked, but it is a counter narrative to the narrative that I've been spinning about how, you know, you've got the if you don't tread gently, there's going to be some sort of social crisis that's going to make life more difficult for people. It's a counter narrative to the narrative that Africans themselves take to the United Nations, where they say we don't want a special rapporteur because this is going to make life more difficult for us. Now, Malawi is, you know, there's one newspaper, there's 4 million people. It's not Nigeria. It's a lot easier to control public discourse in Malawi than in Nigeria or than in Uganda or Kenya. But it's an interesting story.
Mm. Also, just maybe one more bit of information or background on the case. It's also, for me, a very interesting case. Tewange, the trans woman who was in South Africa, I mean, she and her partner, Stephen, they had been together for a very long time in their community and had been, there was a certain level of acceptance. I mean, the people didn't talk about it, but it also is, it's a clear case of sort of that gray line and you know, this access to international or global communication. And so Tewange decides that both because of the experience that they've had within their own community of generally being accepted. You know, or allowed to live together as a couple, she felt that they were at a place where they could do this engagement ceremony,
right,
and there wouldn't be any kind of significant consequences, but they crossed this gray line that they didn't know that they were crossing, and once they crossed it, then, you know, the whole society really, you know, clamped down on them.
No, that's very helpful to remember, but it's even, I mean, from my recent interviews with Tewange, it's even more interesting. Because Tewange told me, and I don't know whether, I know that Ian from OSF has spent a lot of time with Tewange. So I'm not sure whether Tewange has shared this with any of you guys. But what she told me was that she didn't set out to tell me that she was accepted in her village. She comes from a very rural village near Blantyre. But in just talking about her childhood, she told me about how three times a village court was convened because she had been insulted for being gender non-conforming, and as a young woman or as a girl, and at each of these times the person who had insulted her was fined like two chickens, and then the first time so even though and I don't know whether she's creating a mythology, because, you know, people tell their stories. But she says the first time she really thought of her identity as problematic was when she moved to town and started being insulted on the street, you know, long before this engagement thing happened. Mm. But then she kind of made her space, and she had these two relationships, one before Stephen, and then she crossed the line. So there's an interesting progression from the from the village to the global kind of to the global village, which was, you know, not so good for Tewange.
So I'm Jonathan Birchall. I work with communications in the Justice Initiative. So it was a follow-up question about Malawi. What do you think enabled them to achieve that change in Malawi with the narrative? I mean, what were the points that had that effect?
Do you have some thoughts?
I do.
Can I go? Okay, actually, all right. No, but I mean, I think several things. I think smart activists who already had roots in civil society and in the legal reform, in the general reform movement, who now came out. I mean, they've never actually come out as gay themselves, but came to embrace this issue and fight for this issue. I think that had a lot to do with it. And I think their engagement with the global movement, you know, a lot through OSF and through Amnesty, helped them with strategies. Random stuff like the president died and his deputy came in and she was more pragmatic. So those are three reasons I would give. I don't know what you'd add to that.
I mean, I would agree with those reasons. I guess I would say a couple of things. I mean, I think in terms of dealing with the immediate crises of Stephen and Ntuange's arrest, certainly international leverage was really important. But I think, you know, the decision by activists on the ground to invest in some, I think, in very important strategies. I mean, one was to engage with the Malawi Council of Churches, and which, you know, had earlier, you know, done very homophobic things and made, you know, very terrible statements. But to do directly engage with the Council of Churches to create a bit of a counter-narrative around religion and LGBT rights in Malawi was really important. You know, it was with the recognition that, you know, without judging it one way or another, that in Malawi most people are religious, and what religious leaders say has a profound impact on public attitudes, on what policymakers feel that they can do. So getting some religious voices to talk about tolerance, to talk about, and I think also framing the issue as not just an LGBT rights issue, but, you know, one of the ways that they've been discussing. And I don't want to take this too far, because I'm not convinced Malawi's yet a success.
No, it's not a success. No, but the conversation...
Maybe relative, it's all relative.
Yeah, you're right, of course you're right.
Know, talking about the issues, I mean, one of the ways that Joyce Banda, the president, and her administration have talked about the issue is, you know, there's a set of laws that violate the human rights of Malawians. And so the statute that criminalizes homosexual conduct between consenting adults is packaged within this set of laws that are seen as violating the human rights of the people of Malawi. So it's, you know, so I think that's also been helpful in terms of connecting the issue to a broader set of issues that people are concerned about. But I also think it is not a success story yet. I mean, when Joyce Banda talked about this issue specifically, you know, in one of her early speeches after her inauguration, she got a lot of pushback in the country. And when the justice minister said he wasn't going to enforce the criminal statute any longer, he also got a lot of pushback. So I think, and if you, you know, again, I don't know that there's been a recent poll on public attitudes in Malawi. There's been a discussion in Malawi, and that's been different than maybe other
places. There's progress rather than success. There's public, there's rational discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, the two, sort of point number one, I think, and Michael is on this, I know, in terms of playing a role in changing things, particularly in a hostile African environment, is work with media and enable Africans to tell their own stories in media so that it's clear that it's their stories and not the Western story. But secondly, activate allies around intersectoral issues, which was the success in South Africa, you know, and which has been a signal failure elsewhere in Africa, with the possible exception of Malawi. Certainly in Nigeria, it's been a dismal failure. And in Uganda, it's patchy. But Michael used this metaphor, which I use and a lot when I'm talking to people now, so thank you for it, Michael.
I'm going to see it in your book.
Cite it to you. I hope you can tell me now whether it was on the record or off the record. But it's a metaphor about how... there's a bunch of people on the frontline defenders, who are working to bash down the wall. And they're not necessarily the best place to bash down the wall. Because what often happens is that they bash themselves against that wall, and in reaction the wall just gets built higher and higher and higher, and eventually they reel and collapse and burn out. And what you've got left is a high wall. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly your metaphor or whether I'm kind of modifying it. But it's like, who else can be involved in bringing down that wall? And I mean, it's very, very tricky for funders, because those frontline activists really need your support. And if you start, I mean, I know when I was in Nigeria, every time I spoke to LGBT people about allies, I saw like terror, you know? And it's partly because it's become something of an industry, particularly through the AIDS epidemic, but it's also because a lot of the people who have put their heads above the parapet don't really have other ways now of earning an income in their home countries. They're out there. So if funding for them kind of in any way recedes, they're lost. And I mean, this is the, well, not quite, but it's a little bit of the Tiwonga story. So it's a difficult environment. But I'm really, really struck by, in both Uganda, where I have not yet visited, but I've spoken to a lot of people there, I'm on my way there, and in Nigeria, how the allies feel estranged by the way it becomes an LGBT thing, and they don't feel there's room for them, and they don't feel like they are, they feel like it's a they're involved in a competition for resources. Mm. That was said explicitly to me by allies in both contexts.
Giselle. I know you spoke about this at your last talk, but I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit on your time in the Middle East. And also these imams that are promoting tolerance, do you see that happening in the Arab states, or is this only South Africa that we're talking about?
Sure. I mean, that was in Malawi, the imams promoting tolerance. And there's some really interesting new initiatives. Like there's a new global initiative that you guys are funding called the Global Interfaith Network. Mm. And it's got a small Muslim component. But it's with one exception, one or two exceptions, the Muslim leaders of this movement don't live in the Middle East. But one of the initiatives they're involved in, and I don't know whether you're involved in it, is the establishment of a kind of shelter for people from the Muslim world who've had to flee in South Africa, and it's being led by a South African imam named Muhsin Hendricks. And it's really interesting to see the possibilities of kind of diasporic global south centers rather than kind of Amsterdam, you know, where there's several imams, gay imams, as sort of new homes for this movement. I think that's really interesting. I mean, obviously the Middle East is challenging in different ways. And the place I've been working in the Middle, I've visited Palestine and Egypt, and the place I'm working in an ongoing way is Egypt, and I mean, a couple of things to say, which is that that the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, instrumentalized homophobia by claiming that any vote for the secular parties or for the liberal parties would be a vote for gay marriage. And that certainly helped Morsi come to power. And there have been, I don't know if you've read about this, there have been several kind of crackdowns on, I mean, nothing approaching what happened around the Queen boat in, you know, over a decade ago, but there have been several crackdowns on groups of gay men or alleged gay men in Cairo in the last few months since the military seized power again, and using fujur, which is the Egyptian debauchery law, and it's not clear what's going on there, but it's not clear whether this is to what extent this is coordinated, but it does seem to be something along the lines of the military government saying to devout Muslims, you know, we're with you. You need to be with us. I mean, there's that kind of dynamic. I'm not sure. Oh, the other thing I would say is about gender identity. So this is just and again, forgive me for riffing rather than answering questions directly. It's my style. So let me introduce you to Akram. Akram is one of my main characters. Akram is a 21-year-old Kyrene, who I met in one of the street side cafes, which is, there are two of them in the downtown Borsa district, run by older lesbians, and this is the kind of queer space in Cairo. After the coup, the space evaporated a bit, but it's coming back in little ways too. So Akram is trans, identifies as trans, but presents on the street as male. And Akram worked for a while as a sex worker, but is actually now training to be a croupier and works in one of the casinos, and this is, for her, hopefully a ticket out. So Akram comes from a relatively middle-class family and has private access online. And online started experimenting with her trans identity and found a lot of information online and found an online network, but also discovered that she could be, Akram is a male name, that she could be Kulsum online, and started playing with being Kulsum. And her roommate started playing with being her trans character, and developed this whole online persona, and became liberated by this online persona. And kind of lost a sense of boundary between online and offline, and started taking street hormones. You know, and the network that got her to the street hormones was a network that she got online. But online, she met a Saudi trans person who was passing through Cairo, who connected her to a place where she could get street hormones, and she started taking street hormones. And hadn't really planned for the fact that she started looking trans on the street. I mean, she hadn't thought about that. And that is in... certainly in Egyptian society, and I don't know too much about other Middle Eastern societies, absolutely a no-no. There's no space for that. There's no public space for that. And I met a couple of trans people, trans women in Egypt, who do not leave their homes because they transitioned late, so they're not, they won't pass on the street. Yeah. So Akram got into trouble and had to retreat. And luckily, Akram has people in her life who helped her figure it out. And so she went back into the closet and is now waiting until she can get a job somewhere else to do her transition. But of course, what this means is the transition is going to be later and, you know, less successful and all that stuff. But what's she going to do?
I guess maybe just one quick point on Islam, and it's, you know, I think it's still, you know, at a very early stage of trying to figure out how to identify allies, and it's you know, it is very challenging. I mean, the group that Mark referenced in South Africa is an OSF grantee that has been pulling together an international convening every year for the past several years, and I would say it's really at a stage where primarily the participants in that convening themselves identify as gay, lesbian, a few as trans, and they're having a dialogue within among themselves, and it's really sort of reconciling their spirituality with their sexuality, and that's, you know, it's a very important kind of foundation. And then they're beginning to, in quiet ways, engage their religious traditions in the places where they are, but they have to do it in very, very careful ways because there's a lot at risk. And so it is, you know, we are involved in trying to seed that conversation, but it is a very difficult conversation. I mean, there's a great organization, PEMA, one of the organizations, again, that we support in eastern Kenya, that's working in Mombasa, and they've done some incredible work working with imams there, who, again, won't speak out publicly in support of, you know, anything like LGBT rights, but they recognize that there is, within their midst, people who have same-sex relationships, and they're, you know, they're engaging in a constructive way around how to provide services and support to those communities, often with a public health kind of framework. But they're there are things that are happening, you know, but it is at a very kind of early stage.
Thanks. You've reminded me of a really interesting under the radar initiative in northern Nigeria, which is kind of being spearheaded by Zahiruddin Gambo and the Heartland Alliance, which is working with the imams in northern Nigeria. They're not called imams, are they called sheikhs? And in northern Nigeria, there's a trans, traditional trans category called Yandauda, which is very much part of northern Nigerian society, and Yandauda is kind of connected with spirituality in some ways, and there's very interesting under the radar work happening with imams in northern Nigeria to think about pre-colonial trans identities, trans and gender non-conforming and alternative sexuality identities, and how space could be made for this. That's worth following. I thought I was interested in what I heard there.
Yeah, sorry, just to transfer the question. I'm Chris Thomas from Legal, and I was just wondering if you could elaborate more on this trans trender. I haven't heard of that, and I'm really curious if it has caused similar backlash to kind of like the biphobia that has arisen due to some people claiming it to be trendy or at some point or another.
I just don't know. I'm so at the beginning of this research.
Okay.
That I just don't know. I was just struck by it, and I was struck by... I mean, I was struck by... I was struck by how, in some communities, queer is becoming gloriously a place for social misfits. Or in this community, let me say, in this particular community. How queer is becoming a place for social misfits, and who knows why a 14-year-old... Like, some 14-year-olds know why they don't fit in. Okay, so there's Sean and there's Leo. Like, so Sean arrived, one of these social misfits. Looked like a girl, acted like a girl, but just didn't fit in. And found her queer, gender, non-conforming identity through the group. Leo is a trans guy who has been trans since he had his first thought, and who told his parents he was a guy from the moment he could talk, and who also found his way in this group, which is called Riot Youth, and also found his way in this group, and has his own story, which I won't go into in too much detail, but who left the group because he's a guy, and he's a straight guy. And all this kind of touchy-feely, lovey-dovey, pansexual, polysexual, wear everything under the spectrum, just wasn't working for him. He's a guy and he wants a girl. And he's happy for people who are not that way. But it just wasn't his scene anymore. And it's sort of interesting to sort of see their two subjectivities. Sean's, and I don't think Sean is a trans trender. I mean, I think Sean is beyond trans trending. You know, I don't know who in that group is trans trenders, but the organizers kind of, without using the word trans trender, highlighted the phenomenon to me of these kids who might move on, but nonetheless are having much easier. Oh, let me tell you another trans trender story. So the great, and read her book, everybody. Her name's Diane Erin Saft, and she wrote a book. She's the leading therapist who deals with trans kids. She's, of course, from the Bay Area, and she's got a book called Gender Born, Gender Made. And I interviewed her a few days ago, and I left the interview thinking, like, maybe I'm trans, or if I'm not trans, like, I've got to become a trans therapist. It's like, but she said we were talking. I mean, because I said to her, like, I'm, you know. If I were now, would I have become trans or gender? You know, because I was a bit of a girly boy, and I said I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. Like, I'm worried that my parents would have brought me to you, and you would have said, "Oh, like, step off the binary," you know, or "Oh, you like to play with dolls, so you're a girl. Let's make you a girl." And she said, "The fact that you think that means that you're a guy and you've always been a guy." Right? So that, but because I meet so many adults who say, "Oh my God, I wish you'd been around." Yeah. But so just to finish this thought about the trans trending. So I said, "What about you?" And she said, "You know, I was a late bloomer. So I didn't really have an adolescence as a girl. And I grew up in the 50s and it was Marilyn Monroe, and boy, was it difficult. I was miserable. I thought there was something wrong with me. Plus, I liked math and I liked sports, so I thought, I'm a split personality, I must be schizophrenic. And I only really came into myself when I went to University of Michigan in the 60s and discovered the women's movement." And I said, "So what, do you ever think about what if you were a kid now, as a late bloomer?" She said, "You know, I would have probably taken on the identity of genderqueer or trans." And I said, "What do you think about that? Like, you know, look at you. You're a woman. You've got kids. You're very happy." Like, I got nervous. And she was like, it would have been a lifesaver.
Yeah.
It would have been a lifesaver. And who knows what have happened? What would have happened at the other end of it? I probably would have been a transgender. Who knows? But I would have thought differently about gender when I came out the other side with my boobs. And, you know, but, oh, my God, if only that category was around when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I just like, how amazing. Yeah.
I kind of want to speak to that stuff because I think it's really interesting. And as a person who came into my transience as in my early 30s, like, and it being a real revelation, sort of like, oh, I didn't even know this was possible. This is really cool. Like, this is, it's something that's happening. And I think, like, you probably wouldn't have gotten your boobs on because making physical changes is like a real, it's a heady process, and you go through a lot of thought before you actually make those kinds of changes.
It's very intentional.
It's very intentional. But it is interesting, and it's interesting to have watched like this, to be watching this trans explosion that's happening right now, because it's turning into a thing. I think that, like, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot and trying to have conversations with people who lived through that first wave of gay coming out in the 70s and the early 80s, and then like particularly the living of that identity through the AIDS crisis in the 80s, and what was that like for people who were always gay behind closed doors to suddenly be able to be public with that identity? Mm-hmm. And was there talk at that time of like, oh, now everyone's going to be gay because it's sort of but you know, I'm curious to see like how long the explosion lasts. Like, I predict it's like maybe for the next decade or so, and then it'll sort of like shake down into the culture and we'll sort of see how it all rests. But right now, I think that like presenting it as an option for people is such a liberatory move. And I don't know, and I think that the people who are, you know, kind of becoming the face of it as a movement, there's almost an intentional strategy, at least I know amongst my friends who are culture makers and who tour the country kind of doing this kind of stuff or make films, to make it look really fabulous so that it is sort of, you know, towards liberation, towards, you know, not like we need to fight for our rights, but also like, dude, this is available, this is awesome, like this exists. But then it gets back into that shift in like online identity versus where the greater culture is at. But also to speak to the online piece that you were saying, like,
Akram.
Akram, big thing. You know, a lot of the trans women I know have alternate identities and second life and are living out their trans, you know, can in fictional universes where they can be whoever they want to be. And that shift is also, it's...
in such interesting ways. I mean, you know, Charlotte, a trans, Sean's partner, who's an 18-year-old... trans woman, presents as a woman, has had top surgery, so she's got her boobs. Like, long before she came out, she was involved in these, oh God, it's another world, these games online where you develop an avatar, but you're with, you become a team against werewolves. I mean, God knows what. But, like, you know, she was a woman in this team and she made really, really close friends as a woman, and her avatar was female. And then she remained in touch with some of the people in this team and came out to them as trans later. And she just, she modeled so much of her coming out through these online communities.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's just breathtaking. And Leo did it through fan fiction. In really interesting ways. It's, wow, I mean, the possibilities for these kids.
It's also interesting from a kind of movement-building perspective because, I mean, maybe it's always been complicated, and so it's just, you know, reconciling that or living up to the complexities. But, you know, when we think about supporting movements and emerging movements in sub-Saharan Africa, when there was a huge rift within the Coalition of African Lesbians, you know, a few years ago, when some of the leadership began to identify as trans men. And it was a huge battle internally as to whether they belonged in the organization, what their role should be in the organization. And again, this is not unique. It's happened in other spaces as well. But we're seeing a similar, we've been one of the initial funders to fund in something in China called the La La Alliance, which is a national network of lesbian leadership. Mm-hmm. And now mm-hmm. some of those leaders are identifying as trans. And so it's created this huge mm-hmm. kind of complex debate within the organization about, you know, should they form their own organization? Are they really part of our organization anymore? Can they hold a leadership role? It's very, you know, it's very interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, listen, well. I mean, there's battles at Smith and Barnett at the moment around this issue, around these issues. You know, what is a women's college? And in South Africa, I mean, I've watched this in three friends of mine who I've known for ages who were black lesbians, black working class lesbians, leaders of the movement, but who lived through this phenomenon of corrective rape, where gender non-conforming lesbians were and are at huge risk because of backlash, because they claimed space that a previous generation hadn't claimed. And these three have transitioned, the three I'm thinking of, and they're now men. And one is, in fact, the recently appointed executive director of the South African Trans Organization, Gender Dynamics, which is, I think, also one of your grantees. And the one who I'm closest to is a traditional healer named Nkunzi Nkabinde, who wrote an extraordinary book about being my life as a lesbian Sangoma. And in fact, I've got a book that's just out, and there's a lot of her in the book. So buy the book. It's called Lost and Found in Johannesburg. Mm. Need to get that little plug in.
I was going to get it in there later, but go ahead.
Yeah. But there's a really interesting talk later that I want to tell you about because I think it's going to be fascinating. But anyway, Nkunzi transitioned, and Nkunzi's very frank about his transition. You know, a lot of it has to do with Nkunzi has a wife and a kid, and they live in a house in Soweto. And Nkunzi's always been very male-identified, but, you know, with big breasts. And but in their church, they were married in their church, which is a pretty traditional church. And Nkunzi was, before Nkunzi transitioned physically, Nkunzi was understood by her community anyway as a man, even though he looked like a man and like a woman. And the cohering that he did was about affirming his true self, but also he's very clear about it, about making life easier for him and his family in the context in which they lived. And he doesn't shy away from saying that. I mean, he would be very angry if you suggested that that was the primary reason for his transition. The primary reason for his transition is the technology is available and, you know, the movement, there's a movement about this and he found out about it. And he wished he would have found out about it earlier, it would have been possible earlier. But he's very clear about the kind of social context which enables this. Mm. We're losing people, so should we wrap up?
What's this event that you wanted to tell us about?
Oh, right. So Anthony Appiah, who is a Ghanaian... Oh, I didn't bring my bag down with me. A Ghanaian, half-Ghanaian philosopher, gay man... Married gay man, professor of philosophy at NYU, wrote a really, really important book called Cosmopolitanism, which is really about all the stuff we've been talking about. Universal values while respecting, you know, the local and the regional and the whatever. And he and I are going to be in conversation tonight at CLAGS, Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies, at the CUNY Graduate Center at 6:30. And I think it's going to be... It's meant to be around my book, Lost and Found in Johannesburg, which is a memoiry book which deals with race and sexuality and my hometown. But because we're going to talk... We're going to have this conversation, but with somebody who's just fascinating because he's not a gay activist at all, but he's a theorist around identity in such an interesting way. And I've never heard him publicly speak about or write about this stuff. So I actually think it's newsworthy that he's going to talk about it. And I'm really happy he's agreed to do it.
That's great.
So, yeah. So if you can come, it's at 6:30 at the CUNY Graduate Center on, I think, 5th Avenue and 35th.
So I guess I'll just say one thing to kind of conclude from my perspective. And I think the work that Mark has been doing is incredibly useful for us in thinking about our grant-making strategies globally around this set of issues. And I think, you know, one of the things that it reinforces for me is, you know, our investment in supporting people to create a local narrative and the need for that. I mean, there's a lot of other important work that we've supported and others have supported that both complicates things and also I think is important. I mean, the work to support governments like the, or to get governments like the U.S. to integrate concern for LGBT rights issues into their foreign policy and other governments, but that, you know, there are complications with that, but I think it's important. The work at the U.N. level in terms of having a discussion around these issues at the U.N. But I think, you know, what we're seeing is increasingly the limitations of those strategies. Again, not to say that they're not important to continue to support on some level. It's important to figure out how to make those strategies more sophisticated so that they're actually really complementing what local activists are doing on the ground. And I think us as a funder who funds at those different levels has a particularly important role to play in making sure the right kinds of discussions are happening at all the different levels, at the international level, regional, and national level. But I think fundamentally, you know, the connection of the focus of our resources on supporting people to have a local narrative and I think engaging with activists so that they understand, and I think in many cases they do understand, but there's also can be a tendency, especially when you're working in a very hostile social and political context, to want to think the answer is outside that context. So whether it's going to the UN Human Rights Council and complaining as part of the UPR process about the way you're being treated domestically, I mean, I joke now sometimes we could send 500 Africans to Geneva in the next year and it wouldn't do a damn bit of good of difference on the ground. But the, you know, really investing in people to have the conversation locally and also their understanding that they have to, and it's maybe it's, you know, it's a kind of an evolution. I mean, I do think what Mark said is also true, that when we engage with LGBT groups, LGBTI groups, they often complain about the lack of support from the broader civil society. But when you talk to other human rights organizations, they often say that they don't know that those groups don't know how to talk to them. They don't approach them. And so I think there's also kind of pushing groups to come, you know, in each other's direction. But the need to create a local narrative that's not an exclusive, and sometimes this is needed. I mean, sometimes people get into a place where it's the first time they've been in a safe space where they can be with other people who also identify as gay, lesbian, trans, queer, you know, however they define themselves. And so there's a danger for that space also to become very insular. And especially, again, if you're working in a very difficult and hostile climate. But ultimately, nothing will replace their having that narrative with the rest of the people in their country, with the other parts of their society. And so anyhow, it kind of reinforces for us that the idea of this kind of local narrative is really essential to the work. And we just see it play out in so many different places. I mean, I think of your reflections on Eastern Europe. I mean, I think one of the, again, things are both a strength and a kind of weakness. But when I think about the progress that has been made in some Eastern European countries through the EU accession process, I mean, that was an important moment to take advantage of. So when a country is becoming part of the EU, to leverage that to make changes in the human rights legal framework to, at least in a small way, include recognition of sexual orientation and gender identity. But it doesn't. But in places where there has been some progress like that, they still have to go back and do the hard work, which is to actually convince their fellow country people that this is something that is part of their society in the same way that it is part of every society. I think even South Africa. I mean, I think when I think about South Africa, and you know, I'm cautious about saying this as someone from outside the country, but I still think even in South Africa, where again, relatively speaking, there has been a huge amount of progress, and the legal framework is among the most progressive in the world on this issue, but there's almost a need for a public relations or public campaign around making rights real.
You know, so you know, the government has just launched that.
Did they? Yeah.
Yeah, like 3 days ago. Like fascinating. With a PSA, with a really good PSA.
Yeah.
And kind of amazing, they did it just before the elections. Mm. They've decided that this isn't going to
go away.
Well, no, but that it's not going to damage them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.